Hi everybody and welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
There was so much news this week that we've decided to do our second ever news blitz. So we're going to be going through all the big stories in 2 minutes each. But before that, who's this week's guest?
So this week I spoke to Kalpana Fitzpatrick, who is the finance editor at Hearst UK. We talked about the launch of their new Financially Fabulous campaign, how it's being promoted across different brands, and what can be done to improve financial literacy.
Are you two ready? Because we're going to really race through these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You sound ready. Okay.
Born ready.
So here we go. News Blitz begins now. BuzzFeed is spinning off its news site. So BuzzFeedNews.com is the new URL for all its news content. It is separating it out from the entertainment side. Is this something they should have done beforehand?
Well, it definitely makes sense. It's like everyone else we talk about, it's all going to be in the execution. They had the big problem with their serious journalism, the Pulitzer Prize nominated journalism, caught up with cat quizzes and stuff. So good idea, definitely.
So there was a reputational problem. Esther, do you think this is going to solve that?
I don't think they're going to ever lose that kind of BuzzFeed-y. Like, every time you say BuzzFeed, everybody thinks, oh, cat listicles and quizzes. It's going to take them a long time to lose that. But I think it is nice to have, they'll have a sort of sensible surrounding for the news they're doing rather than having some of this absolutely fantastic journalism. Some of the stuff they've broken over the last 6 months has been superb. Yep. But it'll now have a kind of more grown-up house around it. So I think it's a good thing, but it's going to take a long time to shake the BuzzFeed brand.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that they're doing it is they're not doing any native on there, or at least they're not for the foreseeable future. It's all going to be sort of programmatic, and they're going to do a couple of, you know, full-page takeovers. So this is really a lot of reinvention for BuzzFeed's news outlets. So is this just to, you know, an honest effort to separate out the kind of the serious from the silly, as you said, or is this the first step in a sell-off? Because a couple of years ago, I argued that they probably should spin it off and sell it. And I argued it so long ago and so much has changed that I don't even deserve credit for suggesting it then.
But they've take the credit, man.
But they've, so a spokesperson kind of denied the fact that this is, you know, in preparation for a sell-off, but they would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, maybe just give them options. But they're already getting shit for it, you know, because they're still cross-posting on Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, that's 2 minutes. That's 2 minutes.
Okay. Ooh.
So, reader revenue is topping $130 million at The Guardian. So the number of supporters is now at 900,000, up from 10,000 a year ago. And it's interesting that they don't break out the number of those that are one-off payments versus those who are, you know, paying to subscribe long-term. Really good news, though, considering the revenue numbers that came out.
I think it's really great, but one of the things I found interesting about the source of this piece is that Pemcell made a bit of a statement, and he said that he was urged to put up a paywall when he started there at The Guardian. What would have been interesting is if he kind of ran a parallel universe where The Guardian put up a paywall, how many subscribers and how much revenue would they have now versus kind of not putting it up and just going with donations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, their commitment to open journalism is really, it's very laudable, the fact that they are, you know, proving that it can work, but at the same time, they are still making a loss. You know, so you can understand why a paywall might look like safe harbor for them. Is this sustainable, do you think?
I think it is. I think, you know, I can't remember who it was that said it. I think it was one of the guys at the News Corp or News UK maybe, said that he reckoned there was 10 global news brands that could survive.
Chris Duncan.
Chris Duncan. And The Guardian's got to be one of those because there's not really anything else like it. So I think they'll do okay on this. Would they have done better with a paywall? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this year will be the real test point because it's this year that they're aiming to break even.
Yeah, and if they don't make that target, then there's going to be some serious questions asked there because originally people didn't think it was going to be possible. They thought it was a really ambitious target 3 years, and then all of a sudden it looks possible, but if they don't do it, they're going to have to manage expectations so carefully in the future.
I think the good news really is that they're moving in the right direction rather than in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and speaking of things moving in the wrong direction, we're moving on because the circulation of every single major UK newspaper with a cover price has shrank. You know, not necessarily surprising. We're seeing, you know, print circulations fall. But the numbers, when you pull them out this starkly, are absolutely horrifying. So the Daily Mail, which is the second most circulated one, suffered a 12.19% year-on-year fall. And, you know, the Sun was down 7.61%. So these are huge numbers we're talking about. People just not picking up the papers.
We've said this the last time we had the EBCs. It's just hard to find something else to say about this.
Yeah.
I think the worrying point, and Chris, you've talked about this, is that when does it get to that tipping point that you end up in free fall? The numbers aren't there to support the advertising, so the advertising pools, so the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, that's Clay Sharkey's argument. Clay Sharkey.
It's pretty scary. I think he should call himself Clay Sharkey, though. That's a great name.
The argument is that there's not going to be this long tail. And when you look at these numbers, advertisers must surely be looking at these, you know, double-digit figures year-on-year falls and just thinking, well, why should we pay to reach fewer people than ever before when we can reach many more people online?
Well, I think it was a drum that pointed out that this is the reason that this month's ABCs is significant is that it's the fourth consecutive month of print decline in every single leading title, which is not great.
No, it's not. In fact, it's horrifying. And the Drum have done they've illustrated this really nicely. They've actually gone and, you know, graphed out these falls. And you look at them and you just think, well, holy shit. Like, the people who are running these titles must just be thinking, we need to transition to more sustainable revenue fast. And I don't know that I'm looking at any of them and going, they're doing it well. Maybe the Times, but that's about it.
If FT's held up, okay.
Yeah, that's true.
The Times, FT.
So streaming subscriptions have overtaken pay TV for the first time in the UK. Now, that's significant because what with the BBC being, you know, as strong an institution as it is over here, at least in terms of, you know, reach, not necessarily editorially lately, but Netflix, Amazon Prime and Now TV have hit 15.4 million subscriptions during the first quarter of this year, overtaking the 15.1 million subscriptions to traditional pay TV suppliers like Sky, BT and Virgin Media. Does this news particularly surprise any of you, or were we always going to hit this tipping point?
It doesn't surprise me, but I actually think on one level we're comparing apples and oranges.
Mm. In what way?
Because Netflix is not the same as Sky.
No, it's not.
People watch Sky for different reasons. BT, I'm not so sure about, but definitely Virgin, Sky and Virgin. People watch that like they watch linear TV.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not linear necessarily, but it's very different from Netflix.
There must be a decline in linear TV because I know a lot of people my age, and I'm one of them, that apart from the TV license, I don't pay for a traditional kind of linear TV package. I just watch iPlayer and Netflix.
You're right.
I don't have I can't switch on the TV and watch something because I don't, like, it's not even plugged in that way.
So this is really interesting because TV ad spend appears to have plateaued in the US. In the UK, it's having a bit of a rebound. But that's because fewer people own TVs than ever before and fewer people are watching, no, rather people are watching less TV than ever before, which, you know, not surprisingly, it's not a zero-sum game. When you do have these new subscription things like Netflix, which is entertainment, it is inevitably in competition. But it's interesting, though, because TV has historically always been held up as kind of the medium, you know, the great strong medium that's never going to be disrupted. And yet it is, we can clearly see it being disrupted.
I think it's like it's evolving. It's not like that ad spend is going away. You know, you go on Channel 4, you go on any kind of the big catch-up sort of apps and sites and things. It's just people just watching it in a different way, and it's going to take advertising a bit of time to catch up with that.
Yeah, certainly. And Vox, then, moving on, is licensing Chorus, its production and distribution software, to other publishers. Peter, why is this significant?
This is one of these things that, we're not a publishing company, we're a tech company. That old trope got beat to death a couple of years ago. And it's, you know, it's obviously still going on. I worry about this type of stuff, though, because it's not worked for people in the past. You know, things like, Future Folio is the biggest example I can think of. Here's a software developed by a publisher. It's going to make digital magazines brilliant for everyone. And then nothing.
Mm.
So I know Vox's portfolio sites, Verge or Recode or whatever, have done really well on this platform. But I don't know, just selling software, buying software from a competitive publisher doesn't seem right to me. I don't know.
This feels good to me. You know, they're looking beyond just the kind of their traditional revenue models. You know, they're looking to eventually license the software to clients outside of publishing even. I think this is them saying, we have a really good product and we want to make it one of our, you know, major revenue strands. We want another leg on which to stand. This kind of makes sense.
And also they're not the only ones doing it. The Washington Post has started licensing the system that they use in the newsroom. And WordPress is kind of starting to offer something out. They've got kind of almost specialist publisher and media platform that they're starting to use. So there's a fair bit of competition here.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, but just think how if The Guardian, for instance, had, if they would license out their kind of proprietary software or whatever, I'm sure there'd be more than a few people, more than a few smaller publishers who'd want to get on board with that. It might not be a huge revenue generator, but it's money, and it's effectively
right? I think it's a distraction.
Okay.
Support software is different from running a news organization.
Definitely. Moving on then. Comcast has given up buying 21st Century Fox assets to focus on its European Sky acquisition, which leaves Disney as the highest bidder with its $71.3 billion offer for 21st Century Fox assets. Now, we've spoken about before about, you know, this signals a sea change in the Murdoch empire. He's now a seller and not a buyer. But what kind of strikes me about this is just consolidation gone crazy. There's about four media companies anymore. And, you know, great that the X-Men and Fantastic Four might get to, you know, finally join the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I worry about media plurality when, and, you know, this kind of the power of these companies when they are, you know, one or two companies do own so many media assets.
I think that's the issue. But I don't know too much about the TV market or whatever. But when it all starts to get held by one big set of shareholders or whatever, then it is a little bit worrying.
Yeah, certainly. What do you think this says about the Sky, about the sort of European Sky market?
I'm just really looking forward to the X-Men themed section of Disneyland Paris.
Oh, you're right.
Just saying.
Yeah, they've already got the superheroes.
And
section.
Anastasia will now be a Disney princess if this goes ahead.
Wait, so Anastasia will be officially added to the Disney princess canon? Wow.
Yeah, she's 21st Century Fox.
That's huge. Oh, my God. Okay, well, we need a list now of everybody who's going to be an official Disney princess.
Wolverine
is going to be a Disney princess. That's right. Chance the Rapper has bought the Chicagoist for some reason. So Chance the Rapper, dropped four songs, and included in one of them was the lyric, "I bought the Chicagoist just to run you racist bitches out of business." And then he elaborated on that in a statement that said, "I'm extremely excited to be continuing the work of the Chicagoist, an integral local platform for Chicago news, events, and entertainment. I think we can all agree that all acquisitions from now on have to be heralded by dropping four tracks."
Yeah. I'm confused by this one.
Why?
Well, I'm confused because I don't know who he is, because I don't know anything about Chance the Rapper. But also, he's an activist, right? So I get that. He's involved in the community. He said, "I'll live in Chicago till I die," kind of thing. But he's also got some fairly dubious track record.
Yeah.
In terms of media, not manipulation as such, but
he's had bad reviews of his gigs pulled from other news sites, yeah. Which doesn't necessarily
How did he do that, though?
Him and his agent put pressure on them. They said, you know, "We don't think that this review accurately portrays what it was." But he's like, he's a local guy. He's an activist. He believes, presumably, in Chicago, and he wants to support its local news network. And if what it took to spur that was an article that he thought he believes was racist from the Chicago Sun-Times, and he wanted to buy up a competitor, if that serves the public, then that's fine by me.
And also, we have called before and said that one of the ways media will be sustainable in the future is if questionable millionaires buy up newspaper brands. This is just another rich guy buying up a newspaper brand with slightly questionable morals.
Do you remember we were going to start up the speed dating for media moguls looking to buy up things?
Yeah.
This is one I would never have seen coming. You know, we would have seated Chance the Rapper at a table with a Chicagoist, and not once would I have gone, "Oh, they're going to get on."
"Excuse me, Mr. the Rapper, would you like to buy a media property?"
I'd have said Elon Musk was closer to buying a media property than him.
Oh,
but,
God, not talking about Elon Musk this week.
Oh, Jesus.
And I think we're done with News Blitz. A whistle-stop tour of everything that's happened this week. slightly more sedately, this week I've been reading Fact Checkers Have Debunked This Fake News Site 80 Times. It's still publishing on Facebook, on Poynter. And in light of Facebook's newfound commitment to not banning InfoWars or, you know, Holocaust denial sites, that's a different debate whether or not they should. This is a look at the specifics of Facebook's anti-misinformation tool. And it's a really interesting read because Poynter's basically found that it does appear to be working to an extent, but it isn't a runaway success either. When you think about the power that Facebook has to disseminate information, that's huge that it's not working as intended yet.
So this week I've been reading all about the HuffPost experiments with listening circles in Birmingham on journalism.co.uk. So I've been following Louise Ridley's work on this across the week that they did it, and I found it really interesting to see how the different perspectives and attitudes are outside of London. It can be quite easy to get kind of caught up in the London bubble. But the project is aimed to kind of re-inspire trust in the media by listening to the concerns and interests of local people. And I'd say definitely take a look at this and don't miss the brilliant illustrations by Andrew Garthwaite, who drew portraits of the members of the public who came to talk to the team. It's really quite inspiring.
So I was very interested to read a new model for investigative journalism, a piece from the Omidyar Network on why it invested $100,000 in the Scottish investigative journalism outfit, the Ferret, to help it develop its organisation and grow its membership. The piece talks about the Ferret's mission, its first investigation into fracking, which was decided by a public poll, and its record of publishing 530 public interest stories through Scottish and UK newspapers, including The Guardian, and a six-month undercover investigation into a Scottish neo-Nazi group, which has since been proscribed. It's interesting, I think, because obviously it's Scottish, so that's great. But also gives a kind of insight into how the Omidyar Network is funding projects. So if we go from Mr. Chance the Rapper with his loads of money funding stuff to the Omidyar Network, I think it's really interesting that there's definitely different ways of doing this.
This week I spoke to Calvina Fitzpatrick, who's the finance editor at Hearst UK. I started off by asking her what prompted the launch of the Financially Fabulous campaign.
So that's really been quite an exciting few weeks, in fact. So really, so in the past, I say, you know, probably dabbled with some sort of financial content, and every time we've done it, the feedback has been significant. So that kind of prompted us to look into that a little bit deeper and say, actually, you know, this is such an important area that we need to do more of it regularly as well. So really, it's just, yeah, just boosting it up massively.
And who are the women you're writing for? Who's the kind of key audience for this?
So this is actually a cross-brand initiative. So we started it on our lifestyle brand. So we're looking at around 35 plus. But I think it's really for every woman, and it's about money. It's about empowering women. So, you know, I'd like to say it's all ages really. Yeah, and you know, no matter what your age, I think money should matter, and we're in that position where we can empower women.
Yeah, and what are the benefits of having a single campaign run across multiple brands? Because I think on the website it says that this spans Good Housekeeping, Red, Country Living, all those things, as opposed to kind of writing things for those specific audiences.
I think the main thing is that means we've got the power to reach a wider audience. It just makes complete sense, yeah, to make it a sort of cross-brand campaign, if that makes sense.
And what kind of actions is the campaign taking just beyond kind of writing articles? Are there any, have you got any plans for an event or anything like that?
Yes, so it's, if I tell you a bit more about like what the campaign is, so it's Financially Fabulous, so any money content that you see across our magazines comes under the Financially Fabulous umbrella, so to put it. And so it's a newsletter which goes out every fortnight. So within that newsletter, it's a mix of a bit of news, a bit of evergreen content, and also videos as well. It's magazine content. There's events as well. And our very first event, I'm excited to say, takes place in September, which is part of Red Smart Women Week. And it's called Speed Data Money Expert. So it's really exciting because I've got the likes of Sue Fox, who's the CEO of M&S Bank, sort of as one of the experts on there. So it it's already proven quite popular. I've had so many comments about this. And what I wanted to do is create an event where it's not just a corporate style panel. It's quite interactive. It's an opportunity for people to sort of come along and speak to some key experts, whether it's about pensions, mortgages, investing, everyday money management, or buying a house, etc. So, yeah, and we've got the former pensions minister, Ros Altman, speaking on there as well. So it's going to be quite exciting.
Quite nice to get kind of two-way conversation going on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it'd be like mini groups, so we don't want anyone to feel like, you know, they can't ask what they want. And, yeah, so it's, yeah, quite excited about it, actually. I've had a lot of good feedback on this.
And have you got any plans to kind of expand it? Because at the moment, if it's just kind of the newsletter, have you got plans to expand that onto kind of its own social platform or its own kind of website brand in its own right?
It will expand further. And I think even as we just move along with this campaign, the uptake on this campaign has been huge. I know I've personally had so many messages, and it's really, you know, great that we're doing this, because one of the things that we're doing is actually coming from a very positive angle. So it's not about your scaremongering headlines. It's about positive sort of, you know, articles, but more than anything, it's also call to action. So if you read something, there's no scaremongering headlines. It's positive, but it's also telling you what you can do, because there's no point telling someone, you know, you're not saving enough for a pension, but not actually telling them, you know, what they can do about this. So, yeah, so, and again, it all comes down to that message of, you know, educating and empowering women. And I think we're at Hearst in an absolutely fantastic position to do that, because one of the things that I think financial companies struggle with is a lack of trust. And this is why, you know, it's very hard for them to go direct to a consumer. Whereas I think with our magazines and our brands, what we do have is, you know, significant trust. Our readers trust us, they like us. And I know I will talk to people, you know, and, you know, try out products, test things, and, yeah, you know, I'll put that, make sure that trust comes across every time.
Yeah, they're not going to worry there's like an ulterior motive that you're trying to sell them a financial product or anything.
No, I mean, absolutely not. If someone mentions an app, I'll download it on my phone and check it out, etc. But it's really giving women, helping them build their financial confidence as well. Giving them tips, tricks, helping them with, you know, where do they need to go if they need to talk about getting their first mortgage or whatever it is, or if they're looking to retire, you know, they want to know if they've got enough in their pension pot, or, you know, if they're sort of mid-career, they want to take a career break, you know, what sort of things they should need to think about. So it's really covering, or it could be something as like, you know, I'm going away, how can I make the most of my holiday money? So it's a very, like, mixed bag of terms of what we cover, but it is aimed at women, and again, it all comes back to that message of empowering them.
So why do you think women are kind of generally less confident with managing finance? I know that's a huge sweeping statement, but as a gender, we kind of tend to be a lot less confident.
I think it's a number of things. I think traditionally, I'd say financial companies haven't spoken to women, or if they have, it's kind of overlooking their specific needs. Now, don't forget, women live longer. So we are going to have to probably think about how long we want our pension pot to last. It's also about, you know, the fact that we take career breaks. And what I find is when women take a career break, sometimes they don't necessarily go back to work, but they're overlooking the fact that this means that their pension stops, for example, and they don't do anything else about it. But it's also the mindset. So when it comes to things like investing, we talk about risk, for example, but as, you know, women might say, oh, risk, okay, you know, you're risk averse, I don't want to do that. So it's really like, I suppose, you know, my job is to come in and like educate and say, actually, risk can be a good thing, but you have to be in it for the long term, and putting those messages out. And sort of like, you know, people always talk about we want to build wealth, but putting money into a standard savings account might not necessarily be the best move. And it's also things like, you know, they want to save for the children, so they take the back seat when it comes to their own finances. So yeah, there's a number of things, but I think it's the language that is used as well quite often. You know, women will ask the questions. We're not afraid to ask the questions. And I think, you know, we want transparency. We want to read something and understand it as well. We're kind of fed up with the jargon. I think hopefully, with Hearst and Financially Fabulous, this hopefully, it's, you know, things will change.
And is there more that could be done kind of earlier on to improve financial literacy sort of in schools? I know certainly we never covered mortgages or anything like that, even at secondary school.
I think there's a lot that can be done. I think there's a role for schools, definitely. I think financial education is something that needs to start at school. You're right, I didn't learn about mortgages or pensions or anything like that at school. And I wish I had, you know, I always think, I wish someone told me about investing and, you know, I was putting all my money in a savings account. And yeah, or just understanding your payslip, what it means. You know, like sometimes people, especially the younger generation, might see a pension come out and it's like, oh no, someone's taken money out of my account. It's like, but knowing what that actually means and what it's doing for your future. Definitely at school. I think a lot of financial education can start at home as well. I think parents have a big role to play. And that can start as early as age 4, you know.
If they understand it themselves.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've got 2 children and I try and talk to them about money. But just like even letting them pay for things at shops, it's just that small step I think can really help. But yeah, I think, but there is a problem with schools also, you know, teachers I suppose could probably need a bit of sort of education here as well. Yeah, I think there's a big task ahead in terms of making sure that next generation doesn't grow up to be, well, so let's say we want everyone to be financially savvy, so.
Yeah. Do you think there's a bit of a taboo around money for women? Kind of, you know, we almost feel like we shouldn't sort of want to go out there and get rich and things like that. And women almost don't seem to sort of talk about money in the same way men do. Is this something kind of you're trying to change?
Yeah, I think this is a very... I actually believe we should all talk about money. So we will happily, you know, go out with our friends, sit around the table and talk about, you know, healthcare problems, our partners, work, but anything but money. And I actually think it's, I think we should be open with our conversations. I mean, you know, if I'm sitting with a friend and she recommends a beauty product or she talks about something, I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm going to try that. And it's really good that we're discussing this because we're helping each other. But I think that conversation can really translate into money as well. Just, you know, talking to each, and it's, you know, it's mental health as things we're just talking about. It just can take a lot of stress off you as well. It is a taboo subject, and actually I think that's a very cultural thing as well. And I think we keep it private. We keep our problems private if there's a problem. We keep how much you earn private. And I actually think, you know, these conversations need to be open. I don't think we need to live in a world anymore where it's not okay to talk about it, but it's okay to talk about money, basically. And you also notice it, you know, where people... you know, you say go out for dinner, you split a bill, and you're even embarrassed to ask for money that, you know, a friend might owe you, and you just think, actually, no, you know what? We need to be so open about this and change the attitudes there as well.
Do you think that'll kind of help with the gender pay gap if we start talking about that a bit more?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think... I think it's... And in a way, it's good that that's all come out in the open because actually it is a conversational, you know, it's a trigger, and it is getting people to talk about it. You know, so I would just say to anyone, don't be afraid to talk about the money thing. And, you know, again, if you, you know, go for job interviews and stuff, it's all the sort of thing, you know, all matters, really.
Yeah. And you've kind of had a career spanning a lot of financial publications. You've done the Financial Times, stuff for Channel 4 and Mail Online, things like that. And I think you've also got your own website focusing on financial advice for mothers.
Yes, mummymoneymatters.com. Bit of a tongue twister, that one.
Are there any kind of common themes or struggles which emerge, or of the audience, if the separate audiences have got quite different problems?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I would say one of the most common themes for me, and this is sort of stretching back to, so when I used to work at the FT Group, it was about pensions and fund management. That was quite institutional. But I started on pensions. And I haven't stopped talking about pensions, like, even today. So it's a very common problem, and it's something that actually is on everyone's minds at the moment. And it's such a complex area of finance, but it's also one of the most important. And I don't think I'll ever stop talking about pensions, basically. And I think that's one of the sort of common themes. I think women taking career breaks is quite common as well. But part of that does, again, come back to pensions. And also with what's also happened is, over the last few years, obviously, we've got very low interest rates. And so now everyone's saying, OK, where do I put my money? And I think that's a conversation that is, you know, has been opening up, because people do want to create wealth. But again, like, you know, it comes back to educating them why, you know, a bank account might not be creating wealth for the long term. So that's become, yeah, I say quite common in the sense that people are, well, how do I go about making my money work for me? And that's where the investment conversations are quite, so that's pensions followed by investments, very much so. I think another thing that's quite common, probably more in like recent years, is property as well. People trying to get onto the property ladder. And I think the dilemma for millennials specifically as well is, you know, do I put money into my pension pot or do I save for my deposit? I think that's a big dilemma, actually, that a lot of young women are facing.
Especially the rental prices.
And the rental as well. It's like, yeah, what do I do? Where do my priorities lie? And it's just knowing how to navigate that. And also, where do you go for like advice? And, you know, it's, you Google something in and it's just noise.
Yeah. Have you seen kind of a rise in things from people sort of wanting support with freelance financing? Because I think there's been quite a rise in the number of people freelancing. And
you mean people who sort of self-employed, essentially? Yeah. Yes. I think there's the self-employed levels. I mean, more people are being going self-employed now than ever before, actually. And a lot of discussions that I have with women, actually, that, you know, they all say, actually, you know, I'm self-employed. I think there's a lot to be done when it comes to supporting self-employed people with pensions. And I know I've mentioned the word pension so many times, but it's such a big issue.
Wait, same
and
then,
you know,
it's
a core area for our sort of campaign as well. You know, it's something that people really want to know about. And yeah, I think they, you know, they do want to know that if they go self-employed, you know, how do they manage their overall finances? So yes, absolutely. I mean, it's something that I think people will sort of turn to looking for advice.
And what do you use to keep that two-way conversation going? Like, how do you communicate with readers about sort of what they might want to know about this and that and the other?
Well, we have events, so quite often, you know, we get to meet our readers, and you know, we get letters, emails, etc., and we sort of do our own research as well. So we actually recently did our sort of own research on pensions and sort of financial matters, etc. So we kind of get that feedback from our readers quite often, and we have a panel that we can tap into and ask a question if we want to. So, yeah, I think, and also, you know, the fact that, you know, we write about any sort of finance issue, our readers aren't afraid to get in touch, which is fantastic. I'm so glad that they actually really engage with us, and that's so important, and that's such a nice thing to have as well, actually, knowing that, you know, people are actually reading your stuff and coming back to you for whatever reason, asking questions or just giving you some feedback, etc. So that's,
And we finished by asking all our guests what the last thing is they read or saw which really affected them.
So actually, one of the most, I was just going to waffle a bit here, but so the last thing I actually read, actually just last night, in fact, it was a documentary on the BBC about Killed by My Debt. That really, like, affected me because it was about a 19-year-old courier who just got a parking fine, which spiralled into a debt of over £1,000. And it shows just how much money can impact mental health. And, you know, it's so, and that's why actually, you know, it makes me really passionate about this campaign at Hearst, because it's just so important. It's what we were saying earlier as well, you know, talking to friends about money, but talk to your partner about money as well. You know, your children, whatever it is. I think we shouldn't be afraid, and I think we should be encouraged to talk about money. So I'm glad we're just shouting about it every month now. So, but that, you know, it was... Yeah, I mean, it affected me in the sense that, you know, I think it's just sad that, you know, we sometimes feel that we have to shut away and not talk about it. And whether it's just a concern. In fact, actually, Money Advice Service just had a study this week saying, you know, 29% of women lose sleep over money worries.
Oh, gosh.
And it's just sometimes things aren't as bad as you may seem. And I hope, you know, like, just opening up these conversations in a positive way, in talking to women, is, you know, really going to just encourage them. And that's, you know, that's exactly what we're about, encouraging and empowering and educating, and so that we, you know, we can help everyone at all levels.
Thanks for listening, folks. We've had a great weekly newsletter. I'm sure we've mentioned that before. It links to everything we've discussed today. We throw in a quote of the week, and we have a little behind the scenes take and a conversation with this week's guest. Jump over to our website at voices.media Twitter, Twitter page at Media Voices Pod, and get the sign up link there.
Don't forget, we're going to be travelling north to Edinburgh for the best magazine conference in the world, MagFest. We'll be running a podcasting workshop there, sharing our practical approach to podcasting. So you can head over to magfest.co.uk and book now, or look up the link in this week's newsletter.
And it's amazing that we're going to get to go to MagFest. I'm super excited about it, but none of that would be possible were it not for you, the listeners. And being greedy, we want even more listeners to propel us to even greater heights. So please do tell anybody who you think might be interested in our guests, in our back catalogue, in our newsletter, because we really want to continue to grow and continue to provide this new than analysis. So please do tell friends and family, you know, anybody from work who you think might be interested in it, because we really want to continue growing. Until next week, though, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.